guest today is Peter Bergson, a creative process consultant and the founder of two self-directed learning centers. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Blake. It's great to be here.
So let's dive right in. The two self-directed learning centers that you founded, what are they? And tell us just, you know, a quick introduction to each of them, please.
Sure. The first one was birthed by my wife, who died in 2005. But in 1978, we opened a what we considered progressive preschool kindergarten program in suburban Philadelphia. And we always knew, it was our actually raison d'etre, that we wanted to approach early education from a different perspective from conventional schooling. And I can talk as long as you care to listen about this, but the gist, it grew out of my previous 5 years of work as a creative process consultant with a firm in Cambridge, Massachusetts, called Synectics. And my later-to-be wife came to take one of our programs. And in conversation midweek of this five-day program, we identified with each other that what I was doing was remedial in the sense that I was helping adults retrieve thinking patterns that are natural to young people and then get schooled out of them, even starting as early as sometimes a Head Start program or, you know, a traditional nursery school. And wouldn't it be great if there were a program that not only didn't lead these skills to atrophy, but in some cases even try and extinguish the core elements of creative thinking, but in fact nurtured them and expanded them. And simultaneous to this conversation, I was falling in love. It took her a couple years later to figure out that I would be a good life partner, but I knew it on the spot. And in a couple of years, we left our respective positions. She was working in what I call a liberated Montessori school in Connecticut at the time. And I left the consulting world, and we started our nonprofit. And a couple of years after that, after doing workshops and consultations, we started our center, which, as I said, was a preschool kindergarten with the intention of a lot of parental involvement, but it was very much self-directed, which frankly, I think is really easy to do with 3 to 5 year olds, which is the age group that we were working with. And then our first enrollee was our firstborn. And when she was 5 years old and approaching the end of the stated age of our program, our friends started saying, well, what do you, and clients were saying, well, what's going to happen with Amanda when she's too big for the furniture kind of thing? And we honestly didn't know. We were naive enough to think that there might be a private school, a progressive private school in the area that would allow for part-time participation, because we just didn't think that it was 5 years with us and then for the rest of her life, most of her waking hours, you know, out of the home or off doing something else with other people, and our seeing her, you know, nights and weekends kind of thing. But there was no such plan available. As a quick side note, one of the admissions people said to us, well, if we allow Amanda to come part-time, everybody would want to do that. And my response is, well, doesn't that tell you something? But they didn't want to hear that. And So we were really flummoxed. And then another one of our families who had been begging us to become an elementary school, extend the ages and all that sort of thing. But we just did not want to jump through all the state hoops and such. She came up to us one day clutching a sheaf of papers saying, in essence, "Eureka, Eureka, I found it." What she had was an early copy of John Holt's magazine, Growing Without Schooling. And she said, "We're going to homeschool Christian and Emily," which is their two. And I had frankly never heard of homeschooling, let alone unschooling. And of course, at that point, John hadn't coined the term. And clearly, this was a potential path forward. And so the first thing I did was pick up the phone and call John's office in Cambridge. And I spoke with Pat Ferenga. And I said, "We would like to arrange for John to come down and do a sort of conventional lecture with a Q&A on how children learn and why children fail," which I know is not exactly the same as the book title. And then we'd like him to stay overnight and do a second workshop on homeschooling. Because we think that there are a number of families down here who would be interested in that. And to shorten the story a little bit, we did exactly that. John became a great friend over the years. And the first night's lecture was very successful. And the second night's homeschooling workshop, which we held in a large auditorium with a side room so that people could bring their young folks and they could play with a lot of the materials from our center to buy more time for the parents, began the transformation of our preschool kindergarten into a home education resource center.
And just to get some context at this, what year are we in at this moment?
John came down in 83, I think.
Okay. And then I imagine that a sort of homeschool resource.
That's 1983, by yes. the way, not 18.
I imagine that the idea of a homeschool resource center, a place where families who are legally homeschooling can have their kids spend the time of the day, but not necessarily all 5 days a week or every hour of a day that you attend. I imagine that that was a very novel concept at that time. Was anyone else doing that?
There were other people looking at, and the umbrella term that I use is the one of the 60s called open education. There were other people doing open education. There was a private school that, to the best of my recollection, went all the way through the grades right from the get-go, but I know they ended up going through high school, called Upatinas, started by a wonderful lady named Sandy Hurst and a couple other folks. They were the only other and they were some distance from us. They were an hour away. They were the only other option that I was aware of. And to further describe the context that I think you're asking about, when we first opened our preschool kindergarten program, one of the things that we did was we went to a meeting of the Mainline Nursery School Association, I think that's what it's called, just to meet the other directors and announce ourselves in the area and et cetera, et cetera. And our original plan, which we stuck to at that point for this program, was 4 mornings a week. It was 2 hours and 15 minutes from 9:15 to noon, 4 days a week. And at the time, there was tremendous pressure particularly coming from parents with so many, two things, I think, women returning to the workforce and the divorce rate, and therefore women not even feeling that they had a choice. And also what I believe to be the misinterpretation of the significance of the early years with regard to intellectual development in particular, thinking that if a little bit is good, a lot is better.
Mm. So there may be a big difference between 4 mornings a week and 5 mornings a week. How could you deprive that child of that fifth morning, you monster?
And not only that, but there was a pressure for what they call all-day kindergarten. And the public schools were having meetings with parents who were basically, in some cases, maybe it was two-thirds, one-third, but two-thirds of the families were really pushing hard for all-day kindergarten. And so the system wanted more time of the young people involved. And we were going in the opposite direction. And so we knew from the get-go that we were counterculture, if you will, in that regard, as well as the degree to which we were taking a self-directed approach. We had a 10-minute group time at the end of the day just to give a sense of closure and a sense of community. But all the rest of the time, the young people made their own choices of whether they were inside or outside, whether they were working on their own or with a friend or a small group. And of course, there was lots of fluidity there. So there were lots of ways in which we were very different from the tradition.
So I just want to zoom out here, Peter. You started with the preschool, and then you had John Holt come and visit, and then everyone got very excited about homeschooling. And is this when Open Connections was born and it became a sort of center for homeschoolers? And you started admitting older ages?
Yes.
All right.
That's exactly right. And we changed our programming from 4 mornings a week to we kept that for the 4 to 7-year-old group. Pennsylvania at the time was one of two states whose compulsory schooling law did not kick into place until the young person's 8th birthday. Everywhere else in the country, I think Washington State was the other option. Everywhere else in the country, when you turned 5 or 6, or maybe in a couple instances, 7, but for the most part, 5 or 6, you became accountable to the state, her parents did. So the beauty of our situation was that families could delay entry into conventional schooling and experiment with self-directed learning / homeschooling / unschooling without having to address any consideration whatsoever with regard to the school district or the state. That was the good news in Pennsylvania. And I want to just tell you a minute's worth on the political situation, because it does relate to the growth of our first center. In the mid 80s, 85, I think, I was approached by Howard Richman, who was very active in home education in the western part of the state, just outside Pittsburgh, and a couple of other folks, to say, we find the law, once you turn 8, to be really onerous, because the way it was written, you had to get permission from your local school superintendent. And there was no state law that identified the criteria beyond saying that with the approval of the superintendent, education could be provided by a, quote, properly qualified private tutor. And what homeschoolers were claiming was that the parents were properly qualified private tutors. Unfortunately, most of the superintendents did not agree. And there are 501 school districts in Pennsylvania. So there were 501 different interpretations of the law. It was chaos. Mm-hmm. And there was even a situation in a local district where a family had the support of their superintendent and were happily homeschooling with their 8, 9, 10-year-olds. And he was involved on a Thursday in a horrible car accident and had to leave his position. And he was replaced by an assistant school superintendent who was dramatically opposed to homeschooling. And he sent out a letter to all the homeschooling families in the district saying, if your young person is not enrolled on Monday, you will be charged with truancy.
Oh, wow. So this is the mid-80s. Clear, I mean,
yeah, just to try to give you a sense of the atmosphere at the time.
Yeah, so and how relatively easy it is today and forgiving.
Exactly. I mean, it was a major paradigm shift in one way, in several ways. So this group of other leaders of local groups asked me to join representing a big part of the Eastern Pennsylvania homeschoolers to do the work to amend the law. And it was a 3-year process. Howard and a couple other folks did most of the heavy lifting. I was happy to be involved at various times. We had legislative breakfasts out in Harrisburg. We had we organized all manner of lobbying with our local representatives and senators. And it was a real life civics lesson. I learned so much about laws and government and how it worked. And it's a great example of homeschooling for an adult.
Peter, your story really reminds me of Pat Montgomery's story of of exploring all the homeschooling laws in Michigan and essentially getting a DIY, you know, law degree and going to battle with some of the state representatives and ultimately winning.
Exactly. And I think our situation was, you know, its own, but hardly unique. And 1 by 1 and 2 by 3 and whatever, some with the support of the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, some, you know, without that and on their own. And ours was a perfect example, a textbook example, I think, of collaboration between two groups that otherwise tended to disagree fairly strongly on a number of other socio-political issues. But the conservative Christian community was absolutely key to our success, to the success of the mission. And so was the secular homeschooling community, which I represented and some of the others. And we worked very, very well together, knowing that neither of us would be successful on our own. And we had hearings where we had young people testify and we brought in other experts, and we told stories of what had happened to various families that made the Democratic House Committee, Education Committee, which was where such law would have to originate, or such bill, it made their hair curl. They couldn't believe some of the things that were being done. And if if we had time, I could go into them. But just rest assured that that was all part of the explosion of interest in homeschooling, whether it was school at home homeschooling or unschooling or a hybrid, you know, whatever folks ended up doing. And so our programs grew from just the preschool kindergarten program to 1-day programs and 2-day programs for various age groups. Pretty quickly, we outgrew the basically 1,100 square foot building that we were in that had worked so well for 25 young people, ages, you know, 3 to 5. And it was clear that we had to grow. We had to move to grow, if you will. And there was plenty of interest in what we were doing. And in the late 90s, one of our families approached us saying they were interested in continuing a self-directed path for their young people, but only if there were a place like Open Connections that they could use all the way through the high school age years. And they had access to some funding. And it turns out we had access to even more funding that we were unaware of in-house. And over the period of the next year and a half, we arranged for that funding and found a new location and moved from our 1,000-plus square foot building to a 28-acre campus that had a couple of ponds and a very large stone farmhouse and the opportunity to build a second building that we made to look like a converted barn. And at that point, the program started an even greater pace of growing to the point where last couple of years, enrollment was, I think, around 120 or so.
Wow.
Young people and a wide variety of programs and a staff of 25 and all that sort of thing.
I just want to dwell on this moment in the history of Open Connections where you leapfrogged to this much larger space with more than 100 young people enrolled. Because I feel like a lot of people who are interested in starting alternative schools, they look at a place like Open Connections, they look at a school like the Sudbury Valley School, and they say, this is magic. This is how self-directed learning works when you have a big, diverse community, when you have 25 staff, when you have, you know, a stone mansion, and there's a barn to do things like noisier things like music projects. And then they scratch their heads and say, but how do I get there? Because the reality is most little self-directed learning programs or alternative schools start in the church basement, whether proverbial or not. They start in these very challenging physical environments, and the enrollment levels are so low that, for example, you know, once you get your first teenager, that teenager has a very high incentive to not stick around because there's no other teenagers there. It's like I'm hanging out with a bunch of little kids. That's how the teenager feels. So it's this leap from tiny bootstrapped program into this next level, which I think Open Connections is one of the very few examples of successfully making this leap that I think confounds so many people. And it sounds like the way you just told the story, the real linchpin here was having a couple families with money who believed in your vision and who wanted, for their own children, they wanted the larger campus, and they were willing to put some serious money down to make that happen. Am I getting the story straight?
Absolutely. And I would say that the money component is half of the answer to the question, how do you grow and keep growing and become a large enough community so that particularly as they get to be teens, they stay rather than go off to high school. That still happened during my tenure at Open Connections, which was subsequently, the leadership was taken over by primarily by one of my daughters and her husband. We hired a third kind of co-director when I retired. The other half, though, is that you have to have what the families want. And the families are there are two components to the families. There are the parents and the young people. And both, for the most part, have to be satisfied. And even if the young people love it, if the parents are worried that they're sacrificing the positive aspects of the theory of schooling, it's going to be really difficult for them to want to continue with the young folks. And actually, for a lot of the young people, the same is true. It's not enough just to feel free. It's not enough just to have a kind of hands-off attitude on the part of the adults, meaning the staff. There has to be some substantive and conventionally valued intellectual development, and on a level that feels as good as what the young people would be getting if they were in a school that they liked, you know, that served their purposes. I know that, well, I've never been directly involved with Sudbury Valley. I know that there is a sense that the young people on their own generate enough of that. And for their population, I guess it seems to be true. And if there are enough people in the area who are so, for whom conventional schooling is just so unacceptable, then you can allow for more people to kind of find their own way. In suburban Philadelphia, there is, I think the Philadelphia area is much more traditional, even conservative in some ways, certainly with regard to education/schooling. There's no end to the number of private schools. And ironically, the belief is that the school districts in the suburban Philadelphia area, at least in the western suburbs, are some of the best in the country. I personally, you know, have my own opinion about that, but that's the public perception. And so to swim against that tide, you've got to have concrete, demonstrable offerings to combat that sense that young people who are just playing all day are missing out on something really important. And I think we were good at doing that. We hired people who had top quality skill sets, who could figure out how to work with young people on a self-chosen basis. We didn't assign anybody and say, you have to take this class or anything like that. But they put together programs that young people enjoyed, felt empowered in, and believed, rightly so, I think, that they were really learning the same quality content that their school counterparts were doing.
I'd like to talk about this for a second. I think this is a very important point to make. But first of all, what I'm hearing you saying is that for your school or your center to survive and thrive, you need to be responsive to both parents and young people. And specifically, you have to understand the culture that these, let's just talk about the parents for a second, that the parents are coming from. And in the case of Pennsylvania, it sounds like there's this very academic, achievement-oriented culture, and there's all these private schools that parents are thinking, well, if my kid doesn't go to Open Connections, then maybe they'll go to one of these private schools. And so to say, we're just going to focus on total autonomy, total self-direction, play is the most important thing. That's how you develop important creative thinking skills. Like, maybe that won't fly in this specific subculture, whereas it could fly, for example, in the suburbs west of Boston, where the Sudbury Valley School is. And we could theorize about why that works there, but maybe that's not helpful. But this cultural assumption seems to also matter for the kids. And I've seen this all over the place with homeschoolers and unschoolers and kids who go to alternative schools, feeling genuinely concerned that they are not learning the same things that the other kids of their same age are learning in school. And not because they think that they really won't be able to survive in life without being taught European history at age 13 or without being taught geometry at age 14, but just because kids, and especially adolescents, are very peer oriented, and they care about what everyone else is doing, and they care about being a member of their social communities. And so if the center that they're a part of doesn't provide that opportunity for what you said, you know, is like intellectual growth, even traditional academic achievement, then that can be a liability for the whole institution.
Exactly. I would say, truthfully, teens are really not that much more concerned with what their peers think of them than adults are. I see evidence of it all the time. A lot of parents are very concerned about what other parents think, or how they compare and contrast how their young people are doing. I saw this personally when one of my daughters, Julia, the one who became co-director of Open Connections for a number of years, she played on the varsity soccer team at our local public high school. And I remember standing in the stands with the other parents, whom we'd known, gotten to know quite well, because Julia had played youth soccer with them, and we'd gone out of town to tournaments and all that sort of thing. And when it became college admissions time, that's all the parents could talk about was, and they would say things like, well, we got into Smith, but we didn't get in. And what went through my mind first was, what do you mean we? But secondly, it was it's understandable. I don't mean to be completely deriding them, or even partially, but it was an example to me of how important the opinions of their peers were to them. I think that there's a basic need for a sense of belonging at any age. And of course, if you're familiar with the tenets of Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication, you know, that's one of the key human needs, is a sense of belonging. It's balanced by a sense of autonomy, but the sense of belonging is there. And it's obviously very evident in teens. And there are some individuals who are feel that stronger than others. That sense of belonging is another key component, I think, to the success and the growth of a center. And so the fact that we started these kind of mini communities in the larger communities made a big difference. We called them by the unfortunate name group tutorials, but there would be somewhere between 8 and 12, 14 young people who would meet one or two days a week for the full day with the same adult facilitator or team of two facilitators. And they were structurally, in that sense, like the one-room schoolhouse on the prairie. The young people would be represent an age range, but a narrower than the full community. So they'd be like 9 to 11-year-olds or 11 to 13-year-olds and such. And they became generally very tight-knit, not exclusionary, but constructively connected groups. And that's all the number of friends and associates I think most young people really need. You don't need 100 close friends. One really special friend, and then a cluster of people that you feel connected to. And so the organization of the programs fed that basic human need of a sense of these are my people. And then in the same way that I don't know if this is really true, but it's my fantasy. At a political convention, you know, you have the great state of Virginia and the great state of Pennsylvania and the great state of Texas. They all feel special about who they are on the one hand. And on the other hand, they all feel great that they're part of a bigger group mm-hmm. called the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, which in turn, at least this used to be true, I hope it comes back, we're part of an even bigger group called the United States. And that sense of belonging happened. So it's like I go to OC became kind of part of their identity, counterbalanced by I'm a self-directed learner. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a member of the Tuesday, Thursday group tutorial.
Yeah. I think you're describing this difference between the sort of radical individualism of self-directed learning and then the, as you said, the basic human need for a right. sense of belonging in a community. And it's very easy. And I've seen myself fall prey to this reasoning. It's very easy to emphasize the individualism. And I think that even in, let's say like the Silicon Valley tech circles, it's easy to take that logic, which is all we need is more individualization, and say, well, let's just create advanced algorithms that will teach each kid exactly what they need to know at the exact moment that they're ready to learn it. And this is conceived of as some sort of, you know, utopia. And it's really missing that the other half, it's missing a genuine sense of autonomy, yeah. but it's missing this other half, this sense of belonging. And I think that's a tension that's going to remain with us for a long time. That it seems like a very difficult problem to solve, very difficult to find a balance between these two sides.
Well, it's difficult if you believe that there is a one size fits all and you're in a perpetual search for what is the perfect shoe size that will fit every American youth.
Yep. Let's just find that shoe, then force everyone to wear it. That's the answer. Right.
Right. The word diversity, I think, is obviously important in a cultural and a racial and an economic context. I think it's equally important in the sense of personal tastes and personal developmental schedules and personal interests. So I think we need a system that allows people who are interested in algebra to pursue it and go as far as they care to and on their own schedule. And if that means when they're 10 years old, you know, great. And if it means when they're 28 years old, that's great.
You're leaving them behind, Peter. How dare you, you monster.
Exactly. The problem arises with this belief in standardization. And I actually finally got around to reading John Taylor Gatto's history of
The Underground History of American Education.
History of
Huge
American,
book.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he went from a personal realization that what he was doing with the best of intentions as a classroom teacher was in many ways being harmful to his students, to studying the history of the development of the school system, and got to a position that I think most people or many people would view as almost conspiracy theorist type of thinking, that the system was in fact designed by industrialists for industrialists to create a labor force that would be willing to help industry grow by being willing to do repetitive menial tasks for infinite amounts of time for meaningless pay or barely sustainable, and worst of all, to believe that they should be grateful for having those kinds of jobs. And as soon as that, I don't know if it was how intentional it was, but I do think that that's been largely the effect, and with you know, great various gradations, you're better off, I guess, practicing law than you are standing at the same machine working like a robot. But in both cases, if you aren't loving what you're doing, then you are not well served by whatever system helped you get to that level of performance and economic sustainability that you're at. And if I may, I'll use that to segue into dropping the second shoe. I don't know, it seems like 3 days ago, I started by saying I started two centers. The second one I started in 2015 with a colleague whom I met on the board of Open Connections, and who had a great deal of experience in working in the inner city. She was executive director of a large nonprofit that provided all manner of services except education, quote unquote. And when she learned more about the self-directed learning approach, and she learned that I was interested in taking this model into the inner city, the idea of starting a new center that would be directed towards the population that is currently trapped in, you know, the terrible schools that we all know about. I forgot how I started that sentence, but we said, yeah, let's do it. And at that point, I had retired for several years and was ready to jump back in. And so we, in January of 2016, in rented church space, opened a program for 4 to 17-year-olds in the Germantown section of Philadelphia. And for those who know Philadelphia, they know that to be a community that is somewhat racially integrated, but predominantly African American and other people of color. And I did that out of a belief that what they needed, just like everybody else, but even more so than what are referred to as white privileged youth, they needed the skills of creative problem solving. They needed to be able to conceptualize and then act on, accumulate the necessary resources and knowledge and skills to create the life they wanted. And whereas what I saw happening and continue to see happening so much in the dialogue around schooling in the city is just get a diploma so you can get a job. And there was really no or very little dialogue about find out what you love to do and find a way to earn a living doing it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it was just totally racist to limit that view of the purpose of what's called education. I keep putting it in quotes and I can tell you why if you're interested. But I just thought it was like the track system in public schools where they have the academic track and the non-academic track. And if you look at most schools traditionally, they're divided economically, largely. And it just seemed to me to be racist, frankly, to think, well, these families of color, you're suggesting a world that really is not fair. And it's like taking them on a field trip to Neiman Marcus and say, look at all this great stuff that you'll never be able to afford. And I just found that totally reprehensible and unacceptable.
And that's a theme that John Taylor Gatto spent a lot of time thinking about and writing about too, since he worked mostly in New York City, public middle schools, and he worked in a lot of different schools, not just affluent schools. Yeah. And so I had a lot to learn from John Gatto on this subject.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I had a conversation that really cemented it for me, even after we opened, with one, she's 14 at the time. And I said, Imani, how do you see yourself as an adult? What do you imagine that you would be doing? And this was a young girl who just loved to draw, to do animation. And she loved animals, live animals. And she knew so much. And I said, how do you know all this stuff? And she said, watching YouTube videos. And we were able to she really got it on her own, an internship at the Philadelphia Zoo that she never imagined that, you know, she could have gotten before. And when I said, so how do you see yourself as an adult? And she said, well, I imagine, you know, I'll have 2, maybe 3 jobs, you know, so that I can pay rent for an apartment. And I said, could you think for a moment, imagine having one job that you loved, that paid you so much that you didn't need any other jobs. And she looked at me as if I was describing life on Mars. It was a world that she had just, she'd never heard of, or at least never thought she could be a part of. And I don't think I was dangling any unachievable vision in front of her. And of course, there are lots and lots of people of color who already fit that description. But in her life situation, that was not part of her reality. Hmm. And she's not alone in that. And so when I started Natural Creativity, it was as much for the parents as for the young people to say they not only deserve the full pie of whatever is going to make up for a happy life for them, but they have what it takes to get on the train and do the work, take whatever next steps need to happen in order to have that life.
And I just like to point out that there was this documentary made about Natural Creativity Center that prominently features you, and it's called Unschooled. And I enjoyed that documentary, and I recommend it to people. I want to get back to the timeline of Natural Creativity, because this is still a fairly recent project. It was opened in early 2016. You ran it for about 4 years, I believe, and then handed off leadership to two co-directors. And
yes, actually, right from the get-go, Chris Steinmeier, who was had his doctorate from Penn in homeschooling.
Oh wow!
Kind of looking for a place to continue to pursue his interest. He had come to me when just as he was starting his doctoral dissertation a few years before, and I offered him a job at Open Connections, and he said, "I really can't take this job, which I would love to have, and I'll never finish my dissertation." And I guess there's a lot of data out there to suggest that that sort of thing can happen. So he said, "Thanks, but no thanks, but let's stay in touch." And so then when the idea of Natural Creativity came up, it was a no-brainer for me to contact Chris. And so right from the get-go, I don't know, it feels a little egocentric to call him a protege, but we started a process of my unloading everything that I had to share and adding it to what he already knew and had shared, because he had been in several different other organizations, including social justice work and a Montessori school and stuff. So he came with a lot of his own learnings as well, but he didn't have the core element of the creative process work that grew out of my consulting work. And to me, that's the most distinguishing characteristic of the NC and OC philosophy. And I want to make sure that I don't miss this opportunity to say there's a third center that has just started up by my daughter Julia and her husband Mike, with the support of some of the Open Connections staff and many of the OC families, to carry on and extend the Open Connections tradition. They found that they were not able to continue that work the way they wanted to, and felt the need to start up a center over which they had more control. It's called Cupola Academy. They just launched their website. The term comes from the cupola.
Can you spell this for me? Cupola?
Cupola, yes. Cupola. A cupola is that structure that's mounted on the top of buildings, often has a dome and a bell in it. And in fact, that's what we had in the original Open Connections building, the 1,000-square-foot one. And it was kind of a symbol of Open Connections, which we were not able to carry into the new property. But when I sold the property in Bryn Mawr, the new owners allowed us to take the cupola. They didn't want it. And so Julia and Mike adopted it as both a symbol and a name for their new venture. So they're currently in a rented space at a nature center, which is a terrific place. And they're going to be operating out of that for the next year while they continue their search for a permanent location. So that's really what defines our particular approach. And there are very specific techniques and skills in the creative process that grew out of the work with adults that, as I said, were largely remedial, that we've all been dedicated to further establishing and enriching in the lives of young people, because that's, you know, and schools say that all the time. We need creative thinkers. But I don't think they have a clue in the world how to do that. To this day, they haven't read the literature. They haven't learned from the people who are doing it in whatever context. And in the same way that, I don't know if you ever heard the term open classrooms.
Yeah. I mean, it feels a bit dated, but I know it was a big thing in the 70s.
It was a very, very big thing for at least 20 minutes. but all they had was the trappings of what was called the Leicestershire method. In the Midlands of England, they had a very progressive, very hands-on, student-oriented, when they said integrated classroom, they meant by age level, approach to education. And they took these working class youths and helped them develop in ways that had never been seen. In an American educational theorist fell in love with the Leicestershire approach, and they tried to bring it to the United States. It totally flopped because it ran up against the paradigm of compulsory schooling. You know, everything that Gatto and so many others have written about.
So, Peter, I wanted to circle back. You mentioned that the word education, you would say quote unquote education, and you have some thoughts about that. I'm curious what your definition or what you like or dislike about the word education is.
I'm happy to speak to that. The first is, and I know I'm certainly not alone in this regard, I think it's critical to make a distinction between education and schooling. And when people talk about the education system, I think they're talking about something that doesn't exist. And not just because there are so many different approaches to schooling, but that I don't define education as being schooling. For me, education is an internal process It happens between the ears of each individual. And it's the process of, I guess it's the organic process of building synapses and the connections of the wiring. But it's, John Holt called it meaning making.
I like that.
Coming to understand how the world works. And a developmental optometrist named Harry Wax, W-A-C-H-S, and a protege of Piaget's named Hans Firth put together their body of knowledge, which I've also integrated into natural creativity and will be at Cupola Academy, called conceptual development. And conceptual development is an example of the difference between comprehension and memorization. So you can read 100 books on riding a bicycle or swimming, but that doesn't mean you can ride a bike or swim. You have to get on the bike or in the water, and your brain has to figure out what to do to stay afloat or, you know, stay upright and make progress. And that's developmental. It cannot be transferred from one person to another.
This feels like the difference between information and knowledge to me.
Exactly.
Information exactly. Being very easy to systematize and to deliver as if it's a physical product through a network of teachers and schools. But knowledge is this intimately personal thing. And the way that information turns into knowledge is really different for each person. It requires a lot more individual attention and a lot of just personal time and space for that young person.
Exactly. And I would wish to add a third point in that series, even more basic than information, is data. So you can have data and still not be informed. And I think there's so much of that going around where, you know, people are making decisions on the basis of data. They haven't made sense of the data yet. And once you've made sense of the data and you've made sense of enough data, then you get to the point that you just described of being knowledgeable. And I think there are important distinctions. And so what most instruction does is it attempts to transfer data in a way that is informative and even generating knowledge. But that isn't the way the mind works. That isn't so. You can memorize and you can regurgitate, but that doesn't mean you're educated. You're only educated in that area if you have made sense of, own, and can use the inputs that you've gotten.
Yeah. And if you have a personal relationship to it.
Right. And this is basically, that was a long-winded way of saying what John Holt said so much more eloquently, which is learning. He said learning. You and I would say knowledge building is not the result of teaching. It's the result of the activity or the product of the activity of the learner.
I think that is a great place to wrap up our conversation, Peter. I'm sure you and I could talk for 3 more hours, but your career, which seems to have spanned about 50 years, running these programs and doing the creativity coaching before that, it's just incredible. And yeah, thank you for all of the blood, sweat, tears, and money probably you've pushed into this movement.
Well, and I can genuinely say my motives were 90% selfish. It I did it because I love it. And this is what I want for everybody, to be doing what they love.
I love it. All right. Peter Bergson, thanks for coming on my show.
Thank you so much, Blake. I admire your work. I've got all your books, and I'm happy to pass them around and refer people to them. So it's a mutual admiration situation here.